Thanks very much, Rob. The next speaker on the panel is Linda Nolan. Linda's bio is in your package. Linda is a public interest environmental lawyer and consultant, and among her long list of achievements is that she headed the West Coast environmental law for many years. Linda, welcome.
Scott, and thank you to the organizers of the conference. I'm very pleased to be here with so many colleagues from so many different work parts of my life. It's quite a challenge to come up with graphics for water governance, so this one I found, and I thought it was a good one, and it illustrates the theme that I'm going to focus on today, which is shared water governance, which I think can be one of the solutions to the governance challenge that we face today. So what is this photo show? It shows the poor lone regulator standing by himself with his briefcase full of laws, trying to make the decision all by himself. And this isn't going to work, and we know that. And there's a big move afoot, not only in Canada, but in a lot of other places in the world, to try and share governance. And what do I mean by that? This definition of water governance, we've talked about it. We haven't had a definition put up on the board, so this one is from Professor Backer, whose excellent presentation you heard this morning. And I'm not going to go through it, but it's there for you. This is a formal definition. I think more colloquially, we can say water governance is really about making decisions. Who sits at the table, and how do they make their decisions? And those two questions can seem complex, and they are different provinces in particular answer them in different ways. So shared governance, it also goes by many other names, and it's a pretty common theme in Canada today as well as elsewhere. It can be called delegated governance, collaborative governance, and devolved governance. And it does have a number of key characteristics. Rob's already mentioned a few, and I will not go through all the possible characteristics of shared water governance, but just focus in on two in particular. Greater participation both among government levels and also especially from those outside government. And the complexity, I think Rob covered that well, and so many of the other speakers have covered that as well, so I won't dwell as much on the complexity of the issues that shared water governance bodies can address, but I will emphasize the very important role that law plays, and especially, I think I'm going to venture to say federal law. So when you're doing your audit and of federal responsibilities, take a look at the Canada Water Act, which I'm sure you're doing, and how well it's all the many powers it contains have been used, because the powers are there, they just haven't been used. So why do we want to engage on shared water governance? Well, think of that poor lone regulator standing by himself as the water's rising above him, climate change is upon him. But also think about the fights that are out there that are only going to get worse. There's already a lot of conflict over water in many parts of the country. There's conflict between different user groups, and this is only going to continue. Some of the most profound conflicts are going to be, and already are, between economic uses of water and the environment. Shared water governance takes many names. You may not know it by the name shared water governance, but I've just put up here some of the very many different names of new governance bodies that are used across Canada and in other parts of the world. So there's a lot of different names for this phenomenon. And here's where I'll do a little bit of the law. I don't know how well that shows up with the lights, but we've talked already about the overlapping constitutional responsibilities, and I won't go through them in detail. You're all quite familiar with the different ways that different levels of government work together. But, you know, think of an example. Think of one river body, and on that river, a provincial regulator will issue water licenses and enforce pollution control laws. A federal regulator will ensure that fisheries law is upheld and also make sure that navigation's unimpeded, make sure any cross-boundary issues are taken care of. A local government will enforce bylaws for flood protection and land use planning, among other things. And Aboriginal groups will practice traditional activities that are constitutionally protected, such as fishing. And Aboriginal water rights are an extremely important part of the Canadian mix, and I believe we'll have a speaker who will delve into this a little bit more in a later panel today. Bob Sanford did mention it and gave the example of the Piikani. Aboriginal water rights have yet to be fully defined by the courts. They are guaranteed by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which guarantees Aboriginal rights in Section 35. And Aboriginal water rights have been called the sleeping giant of Canadian water law. And if you start to follow the different disputes and the different lawsuits that are going on now, you'll see that this sleeping giant is starting to wake up. So I know everybody loves it when lawyers have pictures of laws. So here I've got a lovely picture of the legislation that applies to water in BC. So shared water governors, so shared water governance bodies, have to coordinate a lot of different laws. And this is just the BC example with the Water Act at the center. The other provincial acts are rounded in blue. The federal acts are listed in the yellow bubbles, and the delegated community local government laws are in the sort of orange bubbles. And even this isn't as complete as it could be. There are other laws that aren't contained in this diagram, which is from the BC Ministry of the Environment. And because we're in Quebec, I also wanted to include the list from Quebec. You heard a very interesting presentation from Professor Kuhman about the new Quebec water law, which is pretty unique in Canada, very unique, recognizing the right to water, the right for natural persons to have access to drinking water, providing no compensation if your right to withdraw is taken away, and really out at the forefront of shared water governance as well. So it's important to realize that here in Quebec, shared water governance is about to really take off with this new law passed last year. Here are some key characteristics of shared water governance. And again, I won't go through them all. I'm working on a primer on practicing shared water governance, plain language, short, accessible, that will be produced with my colleagues at the Program on Water Governance at UBC. So watergovernance.ca is the website. Lots of interesting material there, and it should be done in the next few months or so. But there are a number of key characteristics of these shared governance bodies, usually delegation to a multi-stakeholder group by government of powers, focusing on the watershed scale, greater participation, as I've mentioned, the use of collaborative decision-making, often striving for consensus if possible, and some provinces have actually put consensus decision-making provisions in their law. It's usually a default to voting if necessary. And then, of course, the use of science-based decision-making, which becomes more and more important. So here, the four provinces that I'm looking at in this primer are Quebec, Ontario, Alberta, and BC. Here is probably too small a font, but here is how they compare on with their different shared governance organizations, how they compare on actually specifying who needs to be at that table, one of those key questions that I said was fundamental for water governance, shared water governance. So in the new Quebec law, the law states quite specifically there must be balanced representation, and it goes on to list the sectors that need to be involved. Those include government, native, municipal, economic, environmental, agricultural, and community sectors. Ontario's Clean Water Act actually goes even farther in its source protection committees. It's specified by regulation that those committees must contain one-third municipal representatives, one-third from agriculture, commercial or industrial sectors, and one-third from environmental health and other interests of the general public. So that's quite specific. And environmental groups were the ones who advocated and got that environmental word in that provision. The two other examples that I'm looking at, the Watershed and Planning Advisory Councils and BC's Water Management Planning Committees, don't say in the law or policy what type of representation needs to be included. So they are much more discretionary. And it's interesting in that only the one example that is in effect in BC right now, in the township of Langley, a community that Professor Hans Schreier is extremely familiar with, The Water Management Planning Committee was quite narrow. It consisted of representatives from two provincial ministries, agriculture and environment, and the township itself. So not the type of wide, broad-based, balanced representation that you see specified in the laws of Ontario and Quebec. A different approach. More flexible, yes. Perhaps has some deficits as well. And I'm going to talk a little bit about science and shared water governance, just about the ability of shared water governance bodies, usually as a starting point, since they involve different levels of government, since they often involve scientists, community experts, local stewardship groups. One of their strengths is that they can draw upon a wide variety of existing evidence and also commission new scientific evidence. Often a starting point is to produce a state of the watershed report or some sort of compilation of all the scientific evidence, and this can be quite important for their success. And, you know, some of these themes have already been mentioned many times today. One of the important jobs that shared water governance bodies can perform is to try and make these trade-off decisions between competing water uses. Do fish have water rights, also known as in-stream flow protection, ecological flow protection, and a few other names? We've really fallen down in Canada. There is no jurisdiction, to my knowledge, in Canada which legislates in-stream flow protection. BC has promised to change that by 2012 in its Water Act modernization process. This, again, is an area where the federal government, with its fisheries powers, as well as its numerous other constitutional responsibilities for water, could really play a huge role. And already federal fisheries officers in many provinces do prepare and enforce guidelines about in-stream flow protection, but they're not legally required. Many other countries in the world do require them. This is a legal change that could, and in my opinion, should be made. It's amazing how often the Athabasca River has come up, and I don't have the detailed set of slides that Professor Schindler disturbed us all with yesterday. But again, deciding on competing allocations, it's ultimately the responsibility of government decision makers. But having a shared governance body that looks at all the competing uses and makes some general recommendations, not the final allocation decision, but some general sort of recommendations about how the water should be used can be very important. So this slide from the Pembina Institute on Athabasca River water use is quite graphic in showing that the vast majority of water withdrawn from the Athabasca is for oil sands. And that very tiny little fragment on the right hand of the screen for habitat enhancement, it's somewhat doubtful that that's going to be enough to protect in-stream flows for the Athabasca River. Interestingly, in Alberta, which has quite a voluntary system for its shared water governance, the regional watershed organizations are called watershed planning and advisory councils, and there is no watershed planning and advisory council for the Athabasca region. You would think that for the most water-stressed area, probably the most controversial resource extraction area in the province, that having this shared governance body would be a priority. And one, I understand, is for information, and maybe others from Alberta can confirm this. But it's quite startling that in this area there is no shared water governance body right now in effect. There's a lot of others. There's about 8 or 9 in effect in other parts of Alberta, but none up in this area. And in my opinion, and I am biased in favor of law, I might as well be upfront about it, if the Alberta Water Act actually specified that there needed to be these WPACs in every part of the province, then there would be one in the Athabasca. We wouldn't be 10 years later after the Bow River Basin has been in existence, maybe 20 years, waiting for one where it's so sorely needed in the Athabasca. And climate change, again, an issue that's been extremely well dealt with by my colleague Jim Bruce and others here today. again, this is a very complex issue with multiple competing impacts on multiple sectors. This is just a sample issue about what could happen with lower water levels in the Great Lakes, one likely consequence of climate change. Look at all the sectors impacted, look at all the potential impacts of those sectors, and then look at the overall result, which basically, although called on this slide supply-demand mismatches, is basically conflict and more conflict. And then again, going back to the federal role, looking at the sectors that could be impacted, about half, if not more, are directly a federal responsibility. So the federal government needs to be at the table and isn't in these provincially formulated shared governance bodies to date. I think there's a real role for the federal government to play in looking at how it can support provincial efforts for shared water governance. It does happen in a few isolated projects across Canada, but it's not the standard behavior by any means. So I will end, again, referring to a law that's been referred to a number of times, the EU Water Framework Directive, passed in 2000, sets quite high environmental standards that must be complied with throughout Europe, every country in Europe, no exceptions. Every country needs to form shared water governance bodies. It could be river basin management committees or aquifer management committees, and try and attain these goals by set deadlines that are set in the law. If the EU can do it with their vastly differing set of countries, with vastly differing water resources, cultures, legal systems, surely we can do something similar here in Canada. Thank you.